From the enchanting rainbow room high above St. Pete Athletic in the Warehouse Arts District, this is the podcast of the St. Pete Catalyst. It's Arts Alive. I'm Bill DeYoung. My guest today, Tom Gribben. Everybody knows Tom Gribben. Hey, buddy.
Hey, Bill, you left out the good friend part.
Yeah. Tom and I are good friends. Tom and I will confess, have known each other. I believe it's been 50 years or more.
Probably,
Somewhere in there. Anybody who's listening to this, I bet you either know him or you know who he is.
Or heard a story about me.
Yeah, and how many of those are true?
Right? Most, probably, unfortunately.
Tom, we are here to talk about a lot of things today, but specifically to talk about Bill Edwards, who is a friend of yours.
Yes.
And you worked very closely with him for many, many years. I think it was something like 17 years in total.
On and off, yeah.
You were the vice president of Big Three Entertainment.
Right. He hired me in 2000. To build the Big Three record label, build the studio and all that. I was the executive vice president.
He had made his money through Mortgage Investment.
Yes.
Mortgage Investors Corporation.
Yes. MIC.
It's a mouthful. MICKEY. It's always a bit mouthful for me. Why did he want to go into the music business or the entertainment business?
You know, he loved music. And in his younger years, he was in a band. I don't know for how long.
Huh.
And he always had like guitars around or everything.
Like cowbell, did he?
And I just think that, you know, he had a passion for it. And it's funny because that's really how he got me hooked into it.
Yeah.
He was kind of an irascible guy anyway. And but he was so passionate about it that when he sort of offered me the job, it was his passion for it that kind of, you know, excited me. I went, you know, with his passion and his money, he could do something here.
Why you, though? I mean, hey, this guy, I hear he's got, I mean, you'd had a history with the music business, which we'll talk about, but how did you get to on his radar?
Well, I guess he knew me. You know, he had that club Cadillac Jacks before it became Mr. B's out on Treasure Island. Mm. And the girl who ran it, his girlfriend, her brother was a good friend of mine. And she was from out of town, and he asked me to help her. You know, he knew me from around town and asked me to help her, book some bands, help her with running the club because she didn't know anybody. And so I did. Club did really well. And, she introduced me to Bill.
Uh-huh.
And he had heard about my background, being in a band, being a lawyer, being a writer, being into the entertainment business with the promoting concerts and stuff like that. So
when
he started this record company, we became social friends, and he'd run things by me from time to time. At one point, he had just recorded this girl group, Impress, which is the first group he would ultimately release.
It's like an R&B trio?
It was kind of like, he used to call it a white Destiny's Child.
There you go.
And it was a good description of those girls. And they were really great girls, really, and talented.
So he had signed them to some kind of deal?
Yes. He had started the record company, Big Three or Three Guys. His son, Derek, and Jim McMahon, a guy in the mortgage business with him. And they were sort of following the blueprint set by Johnny Wright and Lou Pearlman over there in Orlando that did NSYNC and Britney Spears. And so I know that he recorded something out in L.A., and one day I was with him, and he used to listen to his music in his car. He said, sit in here with me. And he played it for me, and they were really great songs, turned out to be written by some of the top songwriters that he invested in. But I was disturbed by the fact that they had electronic drums on it.
And
they were really old, soulful songs. And I mentioned, maybe you should try a version with real drums because the song kind of calls for that. Well, he went back out to L.A. and then hired J.R. Robinson, the top session drummer, redid it. And of course, everybody went nuts over the new mixes.
Bill could do that.
Exactly.
That's a hallmark of Bill and your life with him.
Yes.
I'll do it this way.
He tried it. He was one of those guys. He wasn't going to fail because he didn't put money into it. You know what I mean? If he believed in something, and I guess he thought that was a good comment, he went out and did it, came back, everybody loved it. And I think it was during that time, it was over several months, he talked to me about writers and distribution and that sort of stuff, publishing and because he knew at the time I was promoting concerts and doing and you know had to chain of comedy clubs with my partner Bob.
Yeah,
and so he knew all that, and it was during that time he was thinking of hiring me, and then one time he came out to my comedy club out there in St. Pete Beach, and Bob was inside, I was outside sitting in his limo. And he and his girlfriend, who's running the bar, you know, he was off to Monte Carlo. This is a Saturday night. He was off on Tuesday. He goes, "Hey, you want to go to Monte Carlo? I'm going." You know, he's throwing a big event there, golf tournament. He's bringing all of his acts over there. You know, with the Prince. You know,
sure, I'll go.
And you know, and there was all these celebrities. You know, Dr. J, Stephen Stills, Aerosmith. There were models and Formula One drivers and all these people and being involved in this party he was throwing. And so I said, yeah, I'll go. And that's when I knew if he invited me on this, first of all, you know, it was like 3 days later I was on the plane for a week in Monte Carlo. But I knew that he was probably interested in that point of offering me a job.
Wow.
And then we came home. He offered me a job. We started building the record company.
What was that like entering his world? I mean, when you say, well, in 3 days' time, we're leaving from Monte Carlo.
Well, it was kind of...
Got a passport, you know?
He asked me, do you have a passport and a tuxedo? That's what the only two questions. I went, yes. I'll tell you what it was like. Do you ever see that show Succession?
Oh, of course.
It was like that. We went over on a... You know, this big, giant private plane, a reconditioned 727. It was incredible. And then we stayed at the Hotel de Paris, which was right, you know, connected right across the, you know, on the same square as the big casino there. And it was, you know, and you're dealing with the, you know, the Prince of Monaco. What's his name?
the Princess Grace's
son.
Yeah.
So, well, and they were still around. Prince Rainier was older then, so his son, you know, did all the social stuff.
Rainier was still around.
Yeah, he was still alive, and but his son did all the social stuff.
Is it the kind of thing where, oh, I'm in this world now, and Bill would look at you to see how you reacted to it and say, yeah, no. I can work with this guy.
No, he wasn't like that at all. He was a street guy. You know, if you related to him, he didn't care if you related to the outside world. It was great. I remember standing on the deck of, you know, he had chartered this 300-foot boat in Monte Carlo. We were staying in the hotel, but he chartered this boat sort of down in the marina, you know, the most renowned marina in the world. And I was standing on the deck of that boat with him, looking out, surrounded by Monte Carlo as the sun was setting. All the lights were twinkling on in the harbor. And I was going like, you know, Bill, these people have as much money as you. And he just looked at me and went, yeah, but none of them are throwing a party like mine. He didn't, you know, it was like gypsies in the palace, really.
That sums him up. And essentially, what happens is you start the record company. You built a recording studio.
No, it wasn't the first year. He would be recording. He'd either go over to Transcom in Orlando, Lou Perlman, or fly out to L.A.
And this is why he ended up building
the studio. He got tired about it because he was running a mortgage company, which really was funding all of his dreams, all these different things he was doing, especially the record company. He was going like, I'm going to build my own. And he built a studio here. I was involved in that.
Yeah.
He built a studio here that was nicer than any of the studios out in L.A. or
it's a beautiful
Orlando.
Place. I've seen it.
It was incredible.
Yeah. You develop a few acts, and the idea is it's going to be... it never really happened. Never really became a world-beating record label. There were all kinds of business deals that happened and didn't happen.
We released artists. I mean, there's a whole story there about, you know, which path you can take of success. And Bill wanted to take the most expensive path. He wanted to build Motown in St. Pete. Uh-huh. But Motown had a lot of infrastructure, you know, it was a dream, and I, you know, we all got caught up in it, you know, I would counsel him from time to time, this is going to be very expensive, buddy, but, you know, he was developing acts here, he had voice coaches and choreographers, and he would do homeschooling for the younger acts, and he would put them all up in apartments and in cars, and, you know, he was trying to develop what he would be, you know, like, you know, he was... came from Detroit, and he wanted to do Motown in St. Pete. And basically, the key, you know, to any, Bill, you know, the business, the key to any music business or for any artist or for any record label is you need a hit record.
Yeah.
And so the idea was, find a hit record. He felt he could find a hit record. And he was hiring Robin Thicke and all these top songwriters at the time, and they were writing incredible songs, and his artists were singing them. And mm-hmm. and he had charted success, and we had some success. It just never cracked over into the big time,
But
we had Cheap Trick, and we had
you did work with Cheap Trick,
We had that my favorite album, that Rockford album, and we did two albums with Cheap Trick, and we did Rick Derringer.
Rockford was a big three record. I don't think I realized that.
Yes, and we did one with Rick Derringer. You know, Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo.
Oh,
Rick
sure.
Derringer.
Poor old Rick. Yeah, R.I.P.
He wanted to do a smooth jazz record, and so we picked him up. And I'll tell you what. I mean, that album was in the top 20 of the smooth jazz world. I got him on David Letterman. Something like
Can
that.
We talk about the Mahaffey Theater, which Bill took over? I believe it was 2011.
2011.
And Big Three, obviously, you were involved in that whole process. Yeah. Why did he want to do that?
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't know if you know this, but, he tried to do the Mahaffey Theater like in 2005. He wanted to make a run at it and... there's a lot of stories about why that didn't happen. But anyway, he wound up donating $2 million to the theater at that time when he realized he wasn't going to be able to get the bid.
Right.
So when it came up again in 2011, he hired me at the end of 2010 to be part of that team to go out and put the presentation together to get the bid. And when we got the bid, he asked me to stay on. So I was back. I was with him from 2000 to 2005. Then I was off doing my own record company, own entertainment company.
Yeah.
And then he had me come back to help him. I came back to help him. And then when we got the bid, he asked me to stay. So I stayed for another decade, at the Mahaffey Theater. One of the things, he liked to invest in the city of St. Petersburg.
Yes.
If he was going to spend money, that was one of his things. He wanted to do it here. And he had this thing about the Mahaffey since 2005, so this was his chance, and he went and did it. I remember the Mahaffey was kind of run down, and he said, "Well, my name is going to be associated with this." He put, I don't know, almost $2 million in the renovation, all new carpets, all the backstage. Instead of those regular dressing rooms like you see everywhere in these places, he made them like apartments. They were gorgeous.
Yes. Oh, I've seen them, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was important that if his name was going to be associated with it. Bill, hired a lot of people from Las Vegas, and we spent a lot of time there because he was pretty big there. But if you go to any of those casinos out there, they all have a signature smell. And it's a company there that makes a smell, whether it's persimmon and orange, and they do these mixes. And he decided if he's going to do the Mahaffey, he went to that company out there, and they put that signature smell into the Mahaffey. It was wonderful. It was like going into an orange grove or something. It was a mix of three or four different things. And for the first few years, we had that. I think he ran out of affection for it at some point. It got to be too expensive. But I do remember going in there for the opening and going like, oh, yeah, this is like being at the Caesar's Palace.
Wow. Let's talk about a couple of his other projects. I mean, the Sundial was something that he owned for a while. And really beef that place. I mean, it was baywalking from what I remember.
It was not
visiting
only
visiting my parents. It was kind of run down.
It was not only baywalk, but it was there was a lot of petty crime there and stuff like that. It wasn't a place that drew people.
Yeah.
And if you remember, Baywalk, it was surrounded on three sides by those buildings, and then there was another building where they had the Johnny Rockets or something on the south side of Baywalk.
Mm.
It was a whole building with an escalator and everything like that. And I remember walking it with him one day going like, geez, this looks like a prison yard. And he goes, yeah. And he knocked the whole south end down so that now it's all open. And all of a sudden it became open. And we left. And I was going like, is that because I said it looked like a prison yard? He said, it did look like a prison. And he knocked it down. He said, well, we don't need, this hamburger joint here. We can just, and he opened it up into a garden. And he put those, he brought in Michael Mina and Don Pintabona, the chefs, the famous, chefs. Don Pintabona had Tribeca Grill with Robert De Niro, and Michael Mina has restaurants in Miami, Vegas. He's a famous chef, and opened up that locale and that whole thing. And he had high hopes for that. I think Rick Baker helped them, the former mayor, was involved. You know, Rick loved the city, and I think he knew that Bill wanted to do. Bill said, if I'm going to spend a lot of money, which I do, I'd like to do it in my city. So Mahaffey, Sundial, he did a lot of things
The rowdies. I mean, he got overhauled
the,
that
he got stadium. The rowdies. I don't know if he got talked into that, but he loved it.
He got the rowdies out of mothballs. Is what he
did. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, if you remember Al Lang Stadium, if when he bought the rowdies, well, you know, before he bought it, we all walked through there. He took me to Cisco and we went in there. There was black mold 10 feet high in locker rooms and everything like that. He disinfected, redid, restructured that Al Lang Stadium today. You could name it Edwards Stadium because he, all of that, all of the paint, all of the new seats. Mm. He bought these seats from England, those green seats. And painting that rowdy thing on the overhang, you know, had to, that was tricky, painting all that white. But really, the stuff you don't see is where you put the money. The black mold from, you know, it's been flooded a couple times over the decades.
Right.
And he just went in there and made it. And then he built all those midfield seats, you know, those VIP seats on the west side of the field. He just did it first class.
It's I want to go here for a second. I mean, it's well-known people who worked with Bill or dealt with him or knew him, and he could be difficult.
That's a nice way of saying it. He could be a real ass.
Okay.
And he's proud of it. He wouldn't be thinking that I'm talking him out of school right now because he felt that's the way he needed to get things done. And he could be hard to handle, like you say, difficult. It's a nice way of putting it. And he was difficult. I bumped heads with him as anyone who's ever worked with him bumped heads with him.
Right.
And there were times where people saw me bumping heads with him and said, you know, why are you still working with this guy? I mean, that's how tough he could be. And I'll tell you why. Because there was another side of him that was really cool. I had he did a lot of things that they never gave him credit for, or he never asked for credit for. I know down at the old Winn-Dixie that was down on the south side, they were trying to keep a grocery store down there.
Right.
And he went down there and spent $180,000 to keep it, to re-asphalt the whole parking lot. No one ever wrote about that. No, I just knew he did that.
Yeah.
I had a friend of mine who was married to a girl whose brother was a firefighter, and he got brain cancer. And we were throwing a little, he had a little one-year-old baby, and it was just a tragic story. And I had a little benefit for him. And I was one of those guys that, you know, my office opened into Bill's office. You know, the doors swung into his, so I could hear him yelling, you know, 24 hours a day. But anyway, so he heard I was working on this. He goes, hey, what are you doing? I'm doing this benefit. And, you know, this guy, and I told him the whole story, and he goes, well, you're going to help? And I go, well, I'm one of the guys never asked him for money, you know? So I said, well, I was hoping maybe you'd donate $5,000 to this benefit, you know, we're not going to. And he just said, Tom, your friend isn't, you know, it's brain cancer. $5,000 ain't going to help him. And he wrote a check for $100,000 for this guy. Never met him. Didn't show up to the benefit. We raised like another $6,000. We raised a total of $106,000 and $100,000 of it was Bill's. And so I saw that side of him.
Yeah.
And so I just figured if you're in the music business, they're all like Bill at the top. They're all like George Steinbrenner. They're all, they're all irascible.
What does St. Petersburg owe him? I mean, I don't know, owe him. I mean, a debt of gratitude. And it's when someone has passed away, it is, by God, very easy to push aside and not remember or dwell on the not so good parts. But there was so much good that he did.
City. And then that's what I'm trying to focus on.
Yeah.
For every story I could tell that was outrageous. You know, that was just personality. You know what I mean? So I never hated him for it. It's like hating someone who has a lupus, you know? you can't.
One way to put it.
I used to tell him, that's a medical condition. I can't hate you for that, you know? It's like,
yeah.
And so there was a loyalty he had to St. Pete. And I always liked that. And I think the city later on in time, I think the city really started to appreciate it. I don't think that he's unappreciated, because people have started to list all the things that he's done. You know, he resurrected the Mahaffey Theater. He resurrected the sundial. That he resurrected the Treasure Island Yacht Club there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
He put all that money into the Royal Theater just so that the underprivileged kids would have their own recording studio.
Put a studio in the Royal. Yeah,
I remember him taking me and a couple guys down there going, look, I want all this redone. I want these kids to have, you know, and he paid for all of that. And we were all, and he got us all, our whole team. You know, he paid all of our salaries, and he put the whole team on it. So we went down there and did it, and he did that. That parking lot I told you. I could really probably list a whole bunch of other things that he's done when I think about it. And those were the things that I, for the Heart Association, like over in Tampa, he'd buy a $50,000 table. And then tell me, well, I can't go, Tom. You know, go and run the table for me. I mean, it was that kind of thing that he did. He always give money to charities. He was a soft touch to the Florida Orchestra, to the Heart Association. He took over when the Taste of Pinellas was about ready to dissolve. He took that over for All Children's Hospital. He's probably donated more than $10 million to that hospital.
Wow.
And and we took over, and he decided, well, if we're going to do Taste of Pinellas, we're not going to bring in Orleans. We're going to bring in Sheryl Crow, and we're going to bring in Ziggy Marley. You know, he spent a lot of money. Those acts were a lot of money to come out to Fenway Park. And then we built the whole infrastructure, that 70-foot stage and all the everything that goes along with it, the sound and the lights and all the production. He was a production guy, too.
Yeah.
Loved tinkering with production, with the sound and lights.
Well, our thoughts, of course, go out to Mr. Edwards' family and his universe of friends and business associates. And to you, when was the last time you talked to him? Were you guys speaking at the end?
Yeah, I mean, we communicated, but probably 4 months before he passed.
Yeah,
his family, especially on his wife's side, are really close, and even on his side, his kids, you know, they were tight with him, and I remain friends with all of them and his family. I feel really bad, you know, for his wife Joey and his kids, you know, and his older kids, I think, have to process it, you know.
Yeah.
He lost his oldest son, and I used to go with him and his oldest son, Eddie, to the Rowdies games. Wow. And it was a real, it was different than like going with Bill to Caesar's Palace or something. It was a real family thing. I used to look forward to it. I look at the pictures now of us sitting in the rain at the Rowdies games. I think his kids has to, he's got to, his son and daughter from his former life, and I think they have to process it. He, you know, they were very close, and then, you know, I
here we are.
Yeah, I feel bad.
As you mentioned, you know, you had quite a history in the music business even before all of this.
Yes. Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, going back to you, let me go back a little bit. I mean, you had been a practicing attorney for I don't know how many years.
Was that? I was. Yeah.
You know. This is all, you know, public knowledge, and you got into playing music, and you were a songwriter.
I was in the law firm, in my law firm in Miami when I first started. Actually, when I met you, even I would fly up. It was a big time law firm. It was a very well known law firm, and we worked on, you know, the governor's campaign and the presidential campaigns, and we had suits. I had suitcases before the United States Supreme Court. But I'm from St. Pete. I used to fly up to St. Pete for the weekend to make $25 out at, you know, Cake and Cork or whatever.
Cake and Cork Pub on John's Pass.
And so eventually I moved up here. We started that first band, and then it kind of morphed into a music career. I got a record offer. You know, I got a record deal offering.
This is the Saltwater Cowboys we're talking about.
Yeah,
which is still called, which we'll get to.
Yeah, Tom Gribben and the Saltwater Cowboys.
Yeah,
and we got pretty lucky. Uh-huh. We had the first record hit the top 10 over in England and Holland. That's because of that Clash song that we did.
Guns of Brixton.
Not the songs that I wrote, but the one cover of the Clash song.
Well, you know, whatever works, I suppose. Right?
Well, what happened is when it was released in England, about 4 days after it was released, there were these riots in Brixton. And it was the biggest riot since World War II. And Brixton at the time was sort of like a Jamaican ghetto or something. You know, it was a Jamaican section of town, poor section of town. And they had these riots there. And the Clash had released a song a couple of years before.
Yeah.
But we'd put a country version on it, put these Irish fiddles on it.
Yeah.
And so the BBC, when the record got released and the riots happened at the same time, the BBC banned the record, my record being played.
Oh, a badge of honor.
And took it off. And so what happened when that happened, the indie stations, you know, BBC One, BBC Two, they just wouldn't play. The indie stations picked it up. And so it vaulted to up to like number nine. Wow. And we went over there to play. When we went over there on tour to play, I remember being at Dingwalls and looking out from the crowd, and I saw all four members of the Clash.
Wow.
They wanted to see if we could play it live. You know what I mean? And we played it. And we were over there for supposed to be like 3 weeks. And their publishing company added another week and a half or something to our, they paid to keep us in England because, you know, they were making money on the
That's
song.
Very cool. So, look at you cashing in on other people's misery.
I was
misery.
Going like, yeah, well, you know, and Joe Strummer and I became friends. I mean, Joe Strummer was a guy. Here's the guy, everybody. He's the king punk. Him and Johnny Rotten were the two top punks in London. And this guy was really into campfire music. He loved playing, sitting around. The kind of music we were playing was his favorite kind of music. You know, he and his wife were running marathons. He was not the punk. Very intelligent guy. We got to be friends.
So this goes on. The band goes on. You made two records, I remember, because I have both of them.
Yeah.
And eventually, you sort of landed in the comedy club business. Or am I missing a transition
there? No. You know, what happened was when the rock star era ended, you know, here I was, a former lawyer, a former singer-songwriter, you know, traveling musician. So I naturally fell into music business side of it. Promoting concerts,
sure.
That sort of thing. And so my partner and I got into it. We did some stuff with Rob Douglas. He sort of taught us how to best exploit our connections in the music world, you know, that we were coming out of.
But you're doing this here in St. Petersburg.
St. Pete. You know, yeah. I was living here. I was here. The whole time we were, during my record deal, I had already moved to St. Pete.
Right.
Yeah, so all my recording, all that stuff was done here, was done during that time. And then we started promoting concerts out at the old Las Fontanas. It was the old Turtle Club, but I mean, it became the Turtle Club. It was a Mexican restaurant, but they had this giant hall. Nowadays, the sound systems, you know, that you can just plug anybody in. But in those days, the opening act would be on the same sound system as the headliner.
Yeah.
And so to put a band up in front of the opening act, I remember my band opened for Jerry Jeff Walker, and you have to then, you know, the sound check, you can mess up the sound for the headliner. So in those days, we said, let's use comics. We can just use one channel on the board. It won't disturb
all the rest
of the channels, drum sound that we've already sound checked. And so we started using comics. You pay them $25 and they do 20 minutes and get the crowd in a good mood. Then the headliner came out. Then the comics started, just local comics, started going, you know, we want more stage time. We should do more of that. So my partner, Bob, there was an attic up there or an upstairs sort of place where they put tables and chairs and stuff like that. He went up, rearranged all the tables and chairs, put a mic up there. And for $2, like after the show, we did a comedy show.
Oh, it's like, and hey, after this, yeah, go come upstairs.
For $2, check it out. And we did. And
this is so Bob Schumacher, by the way.
Knowing Bob as I do. I mean, here, I can talk about this like I was a partner and all that, and I was involved in this. But I was more interested in the movie, in the music. Bobby, he was in that comedy right from the get-go. So it was really him. He set it all up. It's like 80 seats. And you know how the concert business goes. Sometimes you can sell out and you're not going to make any money. It's a tough world.
Yeah,
we were making more money out of that little comedy room, and so when the restaurant sold, and then it became the Turtle Club and it became a disco club, and we lost our concert hall, we decided to open a comedy club out in and we found out in the Howard Johnson's in St. Pete Beach. Yep. We found a comedy. We found this room this in their bar. It's on Saturday night, and there's two people in there drinking. So we went in there, made a deal, and that comedy club just took off. It was during the time, Bill, when, you know, you couldn't, there wasn't HBO and all that comedy. If you wanted to see a comedian, you had to go to a comedy club. It was the real strength of the comedy business. And anyone who got into that business at that time did well. We didn't know anything about it. We didn't know how to book them and all that. But, you know, we learned.
Yeah.
And so it became, and Marriott owned the hotel. And they,
this was, well, we're talking mid-80s?
This is May of 86.
Okay.
When we started.
This is like the big sort of Def Jam comedy boom.
Before then.
This is pre
this,
that.
This is you had to go to the clubs. Then what happened?
That's what you're saying, pre HBO and all of that.
Pre MTV okay. and all that. Okay. Doing comedy. So what happened is Marriott, who owned it, looked at the numbers and going, well, they had 150 people in here, you know, 5 days a week, and they're rocking in all the bar sales and all that, and they were going, would you like to do it in another one of our? We have a Hojo's in Lakeland. We have Hojo's in North Miami. And all of a sudden, we started expanding to all these. Our deal was being in a hotel. We didn't have to pay rent. We didn't need a liquor license. So we wound up over the course of the history of Coconuts. It's called Coconuts Comedy Club. We were in over 100 cities before. Some would last 6 months. Some would last 15 years.
Wow.
The one we had in the Cayman Island, I think that was 14 years. And that club was making 10 grand a month. And you know, it was people, it was just a fun business to be in. And then, of course, Comedy Central started. HBO. And you could sit home and watch comedy. You didn't have to go to a club anymore. But the clubs are still there. Like,
And Coconuts still
exists. Coconuts is still there since May of 86.
Wow.
It's the longest continuous run comedy club in the state of Florida.
Let's close this out by talking about your book, The Last Florida Boy. Because anybody who's listened this long is going, why haven't they talked about that book yet? You sold a lot of copies of this book.
Sold a lot of copies of this book.
And
that's surprising, too, you know?
It is amazingly funny and a sort of a gripping journey with a lot of humor. Humor saves the day a lot in a lot of things you read. And oh my God, The Last Florida Boys. If you don't know this, folks, it's the story of smuggling, of pot smuggling in
and stand up comedy.
Well, that's true.
And golf.
Okay,
it's really the story of smuggling before it became, dangerous and criminal. These are just guys and their dads, you know, the fishermen. How it started here, when I grew up.
This was the quote-unquote Jimmy Buffett lifestyle before it became corporate.
Right.
And before smuggling became dangerous.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, of course, it is dangerous. And let's just recap, because we can. Why did you write that book? It's fiction, but it's not fiction.
Yeah, it's fiction, but it's when people read it, they go, oh, boy, this is the real thing. And they picture me either on the shrimp boat or in the plane, because it's all written in the first, you know, written in the first person. But it's based on characters that I grew up with, played Little League ball with, who became, who got into the smuggling game when it was amateurish.
Yeah.
And when you read the book, you'll see I'm not talking about the deals that, you know, some of my friends who, you know, got into it big time would take freighters down to Colombia. This was nothing like that. This was all, got, you know, the
shrimp boats.
The small kind of guys, shrimp boats, the guys who kind of started it, the people that you know. And if, for some of the technical advice, I went to a couple of those guys to make sure my facts were correct. The trip to Jamaica and those things. And, of course, I knew all of those, and I was, I think I've said this 100 times, I was in law school in Gainesville when the Steen Hatchie 7,
yeah,
they were being tried in Gainesville. So I went to the trial every day because I knew there were 7 of them. I knew 5 of them. I played ball with 2 of them. And so we'd go out every night, and as I listened to the evidence unravel, I was going, well, that isn't really a crime. And so that planted the seed in my mind. I mean, this book was written over like 25 years.
Yeah.
I didn't just sit down. What happened was I wrote a lot of it, and then when the pandemic hit and we closed down the Mahaffey and everything, I decided, okay, I'm going to finish this thing.
That's right. You know, it's funny.
And you told me, it was you, Bill DeYoung, who told me, you know, you need to finish that. You just can't let the last Florida boy just sit on the shelf somewhere. I remember it. That's when I aggressively went after the publishing and all that.
And you, Tom Gribben, read an early version of Record Man, my Phil Gernhardt
biography,
and you said, you need more with this guy, Rodney Atkins. You need a better ending than this.
Yeah, you ended it too short.
And then I went and I did that, and you were absolutely, so thank you. What's on the horizon? Is there another book in you?
I am ready to announce. I'm more than halfway through my second book, and this book is a nonfiction book. We won't have to play the games of changing the names to protect the guilty. This is a nonfiction book. A lot about my life and the characters that was crossed. But it comes from, you know, I'm older now. I've got two grandkids that are 13 and 11, and I just basically, it's because of them I started writing, you know, they think I'm a fun guy and all that, but they have no idea. And so I wanted to write this script of my life so that they could look back and go, man, old Poppy, he's done some things.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I know you've told me numerous stories of your fabled life.
Yeah,
over the eons, and it's going to be amazing.
And a couple people who have had advanced looks at this thing, including my publisher, really like it. Maybe they just pat me on the back, but I really like it too, and I think that. This is going to be a big party when this is released, and you'll be part of it, Bill. You know, when I was a lawyer, 80% of my work was in writing, whether you're writing motions. When I was, say, go to the appellate court, I'd write 50, 60-page arguments that had to be published before, like, the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals. And then when I got into songwriting, it's the same thing. It was basically, I was doing the same thing as the lawyer, except I was making it rhyme and using a lot less words.
Instead of
a paragraph, you're writing a song, condense your thought down to maybe 7 words. And even then, you go back over the song, maybe I can take one of these 2 words out. And so my mind was already trained to take my thoughts down on the paper. So when I started writing the book, I found, and I tell everybody this, if you can get through the first 50 pages, you're gonna finish your book.
Yeah.
I found as I was writing it, you know, okay, I already have the skill set of doing it, but now I have to make it, instead of convincing someone of an argument, getting them hooked on a melody, now I have to tell a story in a way that makes them keep reading.
Tom Gribben, what a pleasure to talk to you, as always.
My pleasure,
Bill. And we'll get lunch one of these days and continue the conversation.